"Loyalty's a funny thing," said Nathan Inchbell, perched on a rock nearby. The firelight flickered across his face. He looked at Eisenhorn. "Don't you think so?" he asked.
"I do," replied Eisenhorn.
"It is strong, yet it is fluid," said Inchbell. "Strong enough to drag a man to his death, yet fluid enough to flow from one man to another. And it's heritable, too. Passed down through the genes, I suppose, like a living idea that will not perish. Thus it can survive a man's death and pass, say, to his son or daughter, so she might know that loyalty, too, and be dragged down in her turn."
"Not quite like that, Papa," said Thea, sitting on the sand by his feet. "You can give your life to a cause, an ideal. You serve what you believe in. That's what you taught me."
"That's what he taught me," Nathan said, gesturing towards Eisenhorn with his glass. Thea Inchbell looked at Eisenhorn with violet eyes.
"But that's true, isn't it, sir?"
"I have always thought so," said Eisenhorn softly. "I died for you," said Nathan. "I became a target because you were a target. And by association, any who stood with you were in the line of fire. In fact, I was bait. All your staff were. Murdered to draw you out. Oh, don't look at me like that. I don't care. I don't blame you. The work we do is not easy. I haven't come here tonight to twist your guilt." "Does he have any?" Endor laughed as he whirled past with Kara. Nathan chuckled. He looked down and rested his hand on his daughter's head. "I was so proud when she followed me into the service," he said. "Proud of a legacy. My child, in sworn service to the Ordos, and to serve you, as I did." He looked at Eisenhorn. "Like father, like daughter," he said. "She became bait in turn."
"Goblika knew what he was doing, didn't he? He knew how to draw you out, how to play upon what little sentiment you have."
"Come off it, Nathan," roared Endor, as he and Kara danced past in the other direction. "He has none of that either."
"Or was it the other way around?" asked Nathan.
"What do you mean?" asked Eisenhorn.
Inchbell shrugged. "You sent her after Goblika. You knew he would find out about her, find out who she was. The family tie, the legacy link. Father and daughter, sworn allies of the old bastard.
He wouldn't be able to resist killing her and using her as bait. Which means he'd show himself. What a cunning way for you to get Goran Goblika of the Cognite to give away his location."
"It wasn't like that," said Eisenhorn.
"No, it wasn't, Papa,"
Thea cried. "He killed her with an Ursid," said Nathan, staring straight at Eisenhorn. "In a cage. Threw her in alive. Oh, not before he had tried the antigenic on her and watched for days as she screamed through the torment. Another failed test subject. So, into the Ursid cage with her."
"Nathan," Eisenhorn began.
"My child, Gregor. My child. Used as an instrument to advance your obsession. Used and thrown away."
"As are we all," cried Nail, toasting.
Everyone raised their glasses and shouted the words.
"What kind of man uses his friends that way?"
asked Loras Vibben, standing at the edge of the firelight, staring at the flames.
"No one uses his friends that way, Vibben,"
said Midas.
"You had a daughter too," Vibben said to him.
"I'm sure she'll be here any moment," said Midas.
He took a sip of his drink.
"Won't she, Gregor? My sweet little Medea. It can't be much longer before she joins the party too."
Eisenhorn turned from the firelight. Its raging heat was still inside him. He walked away from the little camp into the vast blue gloom of the desert night. The moon glared down at him. He heard laughter and voices behind him.
"Gregor!" Endor ran to catch up with him. "Gregor, where are you going?" "I'm not part of that," said Eisenhorn.
"Don't be daft. You're the reason it's happening," said Endor.
"This is the torment," said Eisenhorn. "This is the deep stage corruption of the antigenic. Breaking down my mind. Delusion. Collapsing memories. Psychic decay. Annihilation of will."
"Hey, we all have bad days," said Endor. "It's not your fault. Just circumstances."
"Titus."
"Yes, Gregor."
"Old Hapshant."
"Him.
Throne rest his bones,"
said Endor.
He took a swig from the bottle of Jolique he was carrying.
"Why did he choose us?" Eisenhorn asked. "To be his interrogators, all those years ago."
"Because we were the very best," Endor exclaimed. He raised his arms and did a little capering jig in a circle around Eisenhorn.
"Seriously, Titus?" Endor shrugged.
"He saw something in us," he replied.
"You know how he died," said Eisenhorn. "Throne, you know too well how he died. The cerebral worms, they destroyed his mind, his judgment, his cognitive function. The doctor said after he died that it was hard to tell how long they had been there. Possibly for years, impairing his critical faculties. He had served for far longer than he was fit, long past the point when the Ordos would have demanded an Inquisitor's retirement. What are you saying? That we were recruited by a madman?"
"What if we were?" asked Eisenhorn.
"I think you'll find the selection screening for Ordo service is a little more rigorous than that," said Endor.
"But he saw something in us," said Eisenhorn. "In his madness, long before the outward signs were obvious. In that collapsing mind of his."
"Yeah? Like what?"
"The spark of something he'd been hunting all his life. The likeness of the arch-enemy he had pursued for so long and so far into madness, he could no longer distinguish between light and dark."
Endor frowned at him.
"I'm no heretic, you ass," he snapped.
"No," said Eisenhorn.
"At worst, I think you're a hedonist who never took anything in his life seriously enough. You like the power of the rosette, the authority, the opportunities. Then, of course, your own madness came upon you."
He looked at Endor's hurt expression. He could still see the worms moving in Endor's eyes.
"What does that make you, then?" asked Endor coldly. "I think that's what I'm being asked to consider," said Eisenhorn. "I thought this was brainwashing, but it's not. The torment, the antigenic, it has no agenda. It simply lays a man bare. It reduces him to his base elements so he can see himself. That is how it breaks will."
"You're kind of babbling, you know that," said Endor.
"I am on fire, Titus," said Eisenhorn. "You can't see it. Maybe you can with those eyes. I am in agony. I burn to the marrow from head to foot with a blood froth. It is so intense now. I can scarcely feel it."
"Have a drink," Endor suggested.
"No, thank you," Eisenhorn replied. "Titus, I've always hunted for the truth, my whole life. And now I think I may have found it, and it terrifies me to see what I am. To see what I may have always been. Goblike and the Cognite, all of them, they're fools. They want to destroy and torture. They want to annihilate. Their motives were simply to hurt me. But there is, I fear, a truth in their philosophy. Goblike has shown it to me. It's more than he knew. He dug into me to find something to break me, but he didn't have the first clue what he was going to find."
"What's that, then?" asked Endor.
"A man. Just like him," said Eisenhorn.
"No, that's wrong. More than him.
Goran Goblika is a hired killer with aspirations above his abilities. He found someone like the people he serves. Lillian Chase. The King in Yellow."
He looked at Endor.
"Could yellow mean flames, do you think?" he asked. "A figure burning from head to foot. On fire, entirely. A symbolic name for someone who has burned through and been transmuted. All that they thought they were, torched away, and only the truth left standing."
"Gregor," said Endor,
"I want to say, just me to you, I have no bloody idea what you're on about."
Eisenhorn looked at him, hopelessly. He tried to put it into words, easy words, but no words would come out. Only strangled unword noises. Endor looked puzzled for a moment, then his eyes slowly gave way, and small worms started to writhe and slide down his cheeks. He stood where he was, frozen. The churring of the insects grew into a roar, a strident, loud, slow click, beating time to their din, the mechanisms of a clock beating out the seconds.
"It's almost time," said Ravenna. Eisenhorn looked up. He was standing in shadow. The huge arch of the Spacian gate was above him. The churring of the insects was the roar of the crowds lining the 18-kilometer route of the Avenue Victor Bellum. 2 billion cheering voices. He could hear the marching bands of the procession approaching, the grumble of the war machines, the thump-step of the Titan engines. He could feel the monumental noise vibrating his diaphragm. This was Thracian, Hive Primaris, the day of the great triumph. Ravenna was dressed in his finest raiment, his inquisitional rosette on his breast, just above the small tribe badge of Clan Esuswedir. The Spacian gate was made of gleaming white ethersite, and it was so tall that great titans could march beneath its span. Ravenna looked up at it. He seemed so young and invulnerable. "This is it," he said, smiling. "Just seconds now. The moment of transformation." He looked at Eisenhorn. "Mine," he said, "most particularly. But yours too. This moment changes you. You are always driven, Gregor, but what happens here today, what happens to me, it propels you on from this point. With a fury, a rage you never lose, it sets you on the path into the dark places, and from here there is no turning back for you. Even though I try," he added, "I try my damnedest. You know what they make me do, don't you?
Hunt for me.
Hunt for you. Hunt you down as a heretic. It will take years, Gregor. It will cost us both. And then, at last, we will stand face to face in the King's City of Dust, and it will end."
"How will it end, Gideon?" Eisenhorn asked.
"Oh, how do you think?" replied Ravenna. "The pupil always outstrips the master."
You see the future, then?"
"Far-seeing," said Ravenna. "My personal heresy. My vice in the eyes of the Ordos. That's the walk into dark places that I'm going to take, because of this. Trapped in that box, struggling to free my mind and see into anything. It will damn me, and the Ordos will have the leverage they need to make me track you down and finish you."
"If you see the future," said Eisenhorn, "tell me this. Who is the king in yellow?"
Ravenna smiled. "Haven't you figured that out for yourself yet?" he asked. "He's been there all the time, since the earliest days of everything."
"I feared he was me," said Eisenhorn. "What I would become somehow."
"Oh, he's that too," said Ravenna. "Come on now. You know what you are. Forget the future, Gregor. No man ever really prospered knowing that. The past is much more interesting.
Think hard. There are only seconds left. Think hard and see yourself. Consider the possibility that Master Imus was right." "No, he..."
"Just recognize what you've always been," said Ravenna. "It'll make it easier for you. No more doubts, no more struggles. Your way will become clear, and it will make it far easier on me, too, when the time comes." He looked up. They could both hear the screaming note of aircraft engines as they began their low pass along the avenue. Lightnings, 12 of them. There were petals in the air.
"Here it comes," he said.
He held out his hand. Eisenhorn reached out to take it, but his hand met metal. He was looking at the armored box of Ravenna's support chair. "Transformation," the chair's voxponders crackled. "Fire. Rebirth." Eisenhorn felt the flash. It was so bright he could see nothing but searing white. Then the flames came. The flames and the wind and the shockwave. His clothes burned away, blowing like ash from his body. His skin blistered, peeled back and shredded. Muscle and sinew disintegrated. His bones, black with heat, buckled and flew like twigs in the wind. She was holding his hand.
"That was all a long time ago," she said.
"Elizabeth."
The sky was white. Old trees shivered in the cold wind. They swayed, their leaves rustling like the chorus of insects. She led him across the wild fell towards the dark valley below.
"Do you not suppose," she said, "it's ironic? The only woman, the only person, you ever loved was a pariah. Untouchable and cast out. anathema to human contact.
The thought had crossed my mind, he said.
The fire will end soon, she promised.
Too late, he replied. It has unmade me. I have rigged through my own ashes, and I understand.
So, use that, she said. You have not been able to save anyone, not really. Not me, not Gideon, not Midas, not even yourself.
You are doomed, and always have been, and so are all who know you.
I should have stopped years ago, he murmured. The Magos was right.
Sark? She asked.
No, Drusha.
Him I don't know, she said.
He's no one, Eisenhorn said. Just a failed man, clutching at the scraps of life, bemoaning his lot. But he said to me that I had gone on far too long, that I had never worked out when to stop. He was very perceptive. He had given up, you see, far too early and far too easily. But he intuitively saw in me a man who had failed in completely the opposite way, a man who had just kept going past any point of reason, his friends begging him to halt, then falling at the wayside as he left them in his wake.
I didn't think you had any friends, she mocked.
Not any more, said Eisenhorn.
So, you see, nothing holds you now, she said. You can walk the last few kilometers without any burden. Nothing matters to you any more. Can you use that freedom for me?
To save you,
he asked.
She shook her head.
Far too late for that,
she replied. She smiled.
But a part of me, I will have. It's hard to explain. A daughter. That's the easiest word, but it's not accurate. She is of me, but she is also me. And another pariah. You've done enough, Gregor. Forget Chase and the king. If you keep going, determined to stop them, you will fail. You'll never have the will, despite the uncommon will I know you have. You'll never have the will to finish this alone. So do something simpler for me. Save her. Save her from the king before the king claims her. Let me have some afterlife in her.
Where is she?
He asked.
She'll be born 2 years from now, said Beckwin. Deep in the maze, in the shadow of the city of dust. She will walk the streets of Queen Mab.
On Sankor?
Yes, like the Jaff woman said. That's where you'll find her.
Your daughter?
She's me, Gregor,
said Elizabeth Beckwin.
Beat her to my Alpha. Think of her that way, and find her.
If it's the last thing I do,
he said.
It will be, she replied. Stop hunting the great foe. You've done enough. You've changed the fate of the Imperium in significant ways. End your days with something smaller. One life.
Will the torment end, then? He asked her. Will the fire go out, then?
Between you and me, it will never go out, she said. But the pain will cease. Do you remember the Sameter Ninth?
The Guard Company.
The veterans, yes. Their emblem was a wheat ear. Do you remember how they kept fighting, years after the fight was done?
They were loyal to the throne, Gregor, utterly loyal. But their war had traumatized them so, they saw enemies everywhere. They fought against the notion of the dark, against every shadow, beyond all bounds of sense or reason.
I remember,
he said.
One of the saddest things I ever witnessed. One of the hardest tasks of my life. To stop men and women from being loyal.
Imagine how I feel, she said.
You mean me?
He asked.
I do, she said.
Her smile was everything he remembered.
There, she said. That's the only time I'll ever get to say those words to you.
I do, too,
he whispered.
You've done enough big things in your life, she said.
She faced him and brushed the soot and grit from his old coat.
Forget them. Do a small thing.
Don't go,
he said.
I'm not the one going, she said. This is where I stop. You go on. You always have. One last walk.
I have to finish this first, he said. Sark. Goblika. Kestra.
You don't, she replied.
To reach Sankur, I must be alive, he said. To find this girl, this daughter of yours. I need to end Kestra and get out, so I can make my way to Sankur.
You don't, she repeated.
The rustle of the leaves had become the stirring of insects, and the stirring of insects had become a fizzling noise. The chuckle of an electrocorporeal storm. He hadn't heard its eerie sound since Ignix, long ago.
The cackle, he said.
You know what that means, she said.
The Regia Occulta had opened before them. Lightning writhed and fluoresced around its mouth. Corpuscent crackled. The wind rose. Eisenhorn couldn't look at it. He glanced around.
I know this place, he said.
Of course you do, she said. I've never been here myself, but you have. The high fells above Antieth, Dakir's world. You used to tell me about it.
Where I was born, he said.
Exactly, she said. Where you were born the first time. It felt like the right place to bring you so you could be born all over again.
She raised her hand to his chin, and he flinched, afraid he would burn her. But she was simply, gently, turning his head, making him look at the gleaming, spitting gateway of the Regia Occulta.
This can take you there, she said. One step. Forget the rest. Forget it all. Go on now, before it closes again.
She kissed him on the cheek.
Take the pathway, she said. It is straight and true, and the only one you need.
He turned, but she was gone. He stepped into the light.
It twists around him and carries him forward. The world falls away, then stars begin to tumble past him like snow. Faster. A blizzard of stars covering the world, raising deep and silent drifts of stellar motes. A heartbeat. A long winter. Centuries snap and pile into one another, like the cars of a runaway train that has left the rails. He sees the Carinines in early summer. The banners flying from the new guardian fortresses. There are armies on the pass, advancing after the spring thaw, bodies released from the lock of winter to move again. The Eudaric hordes, clad in leather and bronze, carrying the skulls of cave ursids on their tribal standards, and bearing, too, their dreams of finding Vartuk and deliverance. Their chieftain rides at their head, his war helm crested with the feathers of a sea raptor. In the woods below, the fortress garrisons muster, sounding the call on brass trumpets that loop around their bodies in a circle. The Carinine guards, forming tight ranks and shield walls in the mouth of the pass, ready to deploy steel blades and precision discipline against the barbarian invaders, and defend their dreams of stable colonization. Iron discipline against feral chaos. Trumpets calling in the woods. Ram's horns blaring from the pass. Redbeaks still trilling in the trees, oblivious. All those years ago. An old man beside a pool, sketching. The low summer sun, an eagle flying. A quiver of extimate spaces overlapping. A room. 100,000 rooms, the people in them. Someone crying. A flame-yellow moon, a bonfire. A Selgioni rug. Laughter. A sea that was not a sea. An immaterial ocean, waves rising higher than all the worlds of ever. Glimpsed bear moths sounding deep beneath the raging surface. Laughter, again. Perpetual laughter. A cackle. Whispers. Words that make. Words that build and unbuild. An old night. Its endless dark filled with insects in their trillions. Churring words that predate the mouths that spoke them. Words that predate all organic mouths. Words etched on white stone. An eye that is not an eye. An eye wounded by worms. A wound in space that is not an eye. An influx. An outpouring. A lie. A truth. A father and his 18 sons.
a transgression, a father and his daughter, a dead girl, another not yet born. Years crumpled like paper, overlapped like shuffled cards, out of order. A golden throne, a figure on it, too bright to see, too dark to name, a figure in a box that is a golden throne. A golden throne that is just a box, a man that is no longer a man. Something once human, kept alive by the throne that surrounds him, seeing all, knowing all, reading the future and trying to forget the past. A mind isolated, a dark place. An old Pict, the image of a son who was everything and nothing, and no way of knowing if the image was made before or after, because he looked the same before and after, and because time was crumpling like paper, and perhaps the before had been the after all along. A wheat ear, a birthplace, something untouchable, someone too afraid to ever touch. A man limping away into blackness, utterly alone, his back turned, carrying on, step after step, for a reason he can no longer remember. A fire. An ancient city on the edge of a desert, everything golden with the haze of dust, a shadow city beyond it, a twin. One place that was two, two that were one. An extimate metropolis. A city of learning. A city of knowledge. A place of cognite. A city of dust. Another king. Another throne. All in yellow. Fire and dust. Eight waiting. 8 points. 8 shots. Blood. Inheritance. The king beckons. Cyclopean demons, too vast to comprehend, kneel at his throne in chains and fealty, whispering unwords, churring like insects, like ticking clocks, like cackling light, like crackling fire.
"You're here now," a voice. "Isn't this where you want to be? Where you've been walking to your entire life? This is what you wanted, isn't it?"
Eisenhorn opened his eyes. Dust fogged his vision. His mouth was full of sand. He was face down. He hauled himself up, spitting and coughing, trying to clear the dust from his throat. The light around him was golden and fogged with powder, a haze.
"The city's right here," said the voice. "You're at the gates."
Which city?" Eisenhorn could barely speak.
"The city of dust," said the voice. "That's right, isn't it?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm right here, too," said the voice.
Eisenhorn looked up. The figure looked down at him.
"Hello, little thing," said Cherubael.
"Why are you here?" asked Eisenhorn. "How?"
"You called me," said Cherubael. "I came because you called me."
Eisenhorn tried to stand. The demon host reached down to help him. "Don't touch me!" Cherubael looked hurt.
"But you called me," he said, "to help you. That's what you always do. That's why you made me. In the end, you see, I'm the only friend you've got. Which says a lot, I think you'll agree."
"I didn't call you," said Eisenhorn. He got to his feet. He looked at the city shimmering in the distance beyond the veil of golden dust.
"Oh, but you see, you did,"
said Cherubael. The demon host hovered in front of Eisenhorn, his broken chain dragging in the dust.
"From the hidden way."
"The Regia Occulta."
"That's the thing," said Cherubael. "I knew there was a proper name for it. The Regia Occulta. You called to me as you walked along it."
"And you came?"
"It's what a friend does,"
grinned Jerubbaal. Eisenhorn shook his head. The fire had gone out. The pain had gone. All the pain had gone, in fact. "I can't have," he began. "I don't control you like that. I have never been able to. It takes months to bring you out, constant effort to bind you and keep you contained. The very limit of my mind and my will just to get you to stay calm. I didn't call you, and even if I did, in my madness, I couldn't keep you tame."
"You can now, Gregor," said Cherubael.
"No."
"Indeed, yes,"
Cherubael laughed.
"I like it, actually. The fight is gone. The constant struggle, me and you, all that pain and heartache, blanked out. You call me, and I come. That's how it works now. I cannot even begin to resist you. I prefer it this way."
"This is an illusion," Eisenhorn said to himself. "It's just another stage of the torment, another mind trick." Cherubeo glanced around. His chain rattled.
"Who are you talking to?"
he asked. Eisenhorn looked at him. "This isn't real," he said to the demon host. "You're not here. I'm not here. I didn't call you, and I know for damn sure I couldn't control you. My psychana's burned out. I must be close to death. The end-stage delusions of the torment."
"No, you're not dead," said Cherubeo. "Not dying, not hallucinating. You simply arrived. This is the place you were always going to, and you've got here. I'm impressed. Honestly, I don't say that to people very often."
"The place?" asked Eisenhorn.
"Physically," said Cherubeo, "and metaphysically. I suppose you get to decide which matters more. The physical place is the city of dust, inside the city of Queen Mab, on Sankor, in the Angelus subsector. The year is 500, give or take a year. Metaphysically, well, that's up to you."
"Sankor?"
"Yes, yes. Absolutely dreadful place between you and me, but not my choice. You call the shots now. You did want to be here, didn't you?"
"Yes," said Eisenhorn. I don't know."
"It's where she asked you to go,"
said Cherubeo.
"That untouchable of yours. You know, what's her name?"
"Elizabeth."
"Yes, Elizabeth. She asked you nicely."
"It was just the torment in her form."
"She asked you nicely anyway. She asked you a favor, a last favor. Save her daughter. I suppose that's what you're going to do. You'd do anything for her."
The demon host saw Eisenhorn looking at the spectral city.
"Or have you changed your mind, Gregor?"
he asked.
"Are you still tempted? One final push to bring the arch-enemy down?"
"I don't know. I don't know if any of it was true."
"Seems to me you have a choice. Do the right thing, or do the right thing. I know that doesn't sound like a choice. You know what I mean. Do the big thing that matters, or the small thing that counts."
"Can't I do both?" asked Eisenhorn.
"I don't know,"
asked Cherubeo.
"Can you?"
Eisenhorn didn't reply.
I suppose, said Cherubael, it comes down to what matters most to you. Obligation to, you know, I don't like to say his name. Let's call him the God-Rot King. Or obligation to those who counted on you. Personally, I mean. Let's call them, and here's another word I don't like to use, friends.
I don't have any friends, said Eisenhorn.
No, you don't. And I've always liked that about you,
said Cherubael.
But how can I put it? Friends have you. People have befriended you to their cost. They have stuck to you. They have stayed with you. They have been loyal through everything. You've just never really been loyal back, which is odd, because loyalty is your big thing.
The two things have always conflicted, said Eisenhorn.
But?
I want to do the right thing, said Eisenhorn. I have always wanted to do the right thing. I'm damned because of it.
So?
I choose both. And choosing both means I don't start here.
Cherubael sighed.
We're not staying then?
He asked.
I'm not. I have something to finish. I have to retrace my steps.
Have I got to carry you?
I don't think you do.
Well,
said Cherubael,
I'll be waiting for you then.
You will?
Like a good boy. That's what you want. So that's what I'll do. I'll wait right here until you get back. See you in, about 20 years.
Eisenhorn looked at the demon host and shook his head.
Off you go,
said Cherubael. He gave a little wave.
Good luck and all that. That is what friends say, isn't it?
Why, said Eisenhorn, why are you being so nice to me?
Well, because, quite frankly,
said Cherubael,
and please don't tell anyone, but right now, you scare the absolute shit out of me.
Eisenhorn smiled.
Hang on,
said Cherubael.
I didn't think you could do that anymore.
Neither did I,
said Eisenhorn. He raised his hand. The fire leapt up.